Thank you, Prime Minister. Tēnā koutou katoa. So today we have two new confirmed cases and one new probable case of COVID-19 to report. However, there is actually no change in the total number of COVID-19 cases in New Zealand, which remains at 1,451, the same as yesterday. Let me briefly explain. There were three cases we reported yesterday who were confirmed cases off the Greg Mortimer ship that had been where people had been repatriated from Uruguay. However, we understand that their original testing was done in Uruguay, and we are checking with the authorities there as to whether they have already reported them to the WHO to make sure that the World Health Organization totals are accurate. So to report, again, just to reiterate, two new confirmed and one new probable case. Our laboratories processed a record 6,480 tests yesterday. So if you look at the new confirmed cases, less than 0.05% were positive. And we've now processed 101,277 tests for COVID-19. All the cases we're reporting today are linked to existing cases. Sadly, today I have two further deaths to report as a result of COVID-19 infection. A patient has died who has been very unwell in intensive care in Dunedin Hospital with COVID-19 since 7th of April. She was in her 60s and had an underlying health condition. While her family had not been able to visit her over the past few weeks, arrangements were made for them to be with her last night as she passed away. The second death is a resident at Rosewood Rest Home in Christchurch. This man in his 70s passed away in the hospital level wing of that unit last night. He was not part of the group that had been transferred to Burwood Hospital. The man had an underlying condition, and while he had tested negative for COVID-19, he was considered a probable case based on his exposure and symptoms. And as I have said before, these probable cases are treated as if they are positive and managed in the same way, and we are including them in all our statistics, including our mortality statistics. My sympathies go out to the families of both of these people, and once again we are reminded of the serious threat that this infection poses to individuals and our communities. Today there are eight people in hospital with COVID-19, and one person is in ICU in Middlemore Hospital. There are still the same 16 significant clusters, and four additional cases have now been linked to those clusters. Some brief comments on health services under level 3 in advance of heading into that alert level. So hospitals remain open for emergency and acute care, of course, and I encourage all people to seek acute care for whatever their condition through either Healthline or their GP or at the hospital. Some elective services, including surgery and radiology, will be provided under alert level 3, and more detail will follow on that. In aged residential care, only family visits for palliative and compassionate care reasons will be considered, and that will be on a case-by-case basis. General practices, of course, will be open as they have been through alert level 4, and they will be continuing to conduct virtual consultations as much as possible. If you have symptoms of COVID-19 or respiratory symptoms, please seek help through Healthline or by calling ahead to your regular doctor. Community pharmacies remain open. Dental services may provide urgent face-to-face appointments under alert level 3, but not routine dental care. Community midwives will continue to do the fantastic work they do with pregnant women out in the community, using virtual means where possible, but also face-to-face. And there will be an allowance for some face-to-face services for physiotherapy, podiatry and optometry and so on, where urgent care is required, but they will continue to provide services as much as possible virtually. And finally, community mental health service appointments will continue to be done virtual means or on by phone where possible, face-to-face appointments if necessary. And you'll have seen the Minister of Health just announced that he's asked me to do a quick stocktake around all our district health boards on the processes they are using to distribute PPE to our providers based in the community, so we can get an idea of what PPE is going out, how quickly they are responding to orders, and how any concerns are dealt with. Thank you, Prime Minister.
Thank you, Dr. Bloomfield. Later today, the Director of Civil Defence Emergency Management, Sarah Stewart-Black, will give an update on what our civil defence groups across the country have been doing to support vulnerable New Zealanders. She'll also be joined by Police Commissioner Andy Costa for a briefing. The work that's been done by our civil defence group may be going unnoticed to the vast majority of New Zealanders while everyone is in their bubbles, but it is work that keeps people who would otherwise be without fed, warm and well. We have been working hard to ensure that we're meeting need where it exists, which is why yesterday we put another $30 million into our civil defence group so they can keep providing food parcels, household goods and accommodation where it's required. And that follows the immediate assistance, you'll remember some time ago, of $27 million put in to support that work. And so on the ground, 16 local civil defence groups are doing what they do best. They're coordinating across all government agencies, organisations, including NGOs, iwi and community-based groups. While COVID-19 may seem like a different kind of emergency to what we've dealt with in recent years, like floods and fires, the role of civil defence is very much the same, ensuring communities, individuals, families and whānau have the support they need. There is an 0800 number for every group that people can call if they are out of supplies or struggling to get basic food. They've been providing emergency accommodation, a stopgap service, before they are referred to MB's temporary accommodation service. This is business as usual for them, but they also now have powers activated by the state of national emergency in support of the COVID-19 response, as you're all well aware. So far, that's been used for things like closing roads to prevent vehicle access to backcountry to stop activities that might result in rescue activity. In Taranaki, they have moved on freedom campers. In Canterbury, they've requisitioned a car park for use as a community-based assessment centre. Coordination is a role not to be underestimated. It's what helps get what is required to those who need it most. And I do want to pass on my thanks to the amazing work that's been done by those civil defence groups in our local areas. Short word on hunting. While food parcels keep families fed, we know that in many parts of New Zealand, hunting is also a part of providing for many people's families and whānau. You would have seen that decisions have now been made for this activity, Alert Level 3. Hunting can go ahead under Alert Level 3, so long as you stay in your region, so long as you stay in your bubble. And we're asking that people please don't put themselves at risk of needing rescue. So that means don't use quad bikes, off-road motorbikes or any motorised vehicles for the purposes of hunting. Dock land is closed for tramping and other activities and also for hunting at Level 3. On private land, you'll of course need landowners' permission. Hunting is an important part of life for many New Zealanders. In many places around the country, it fills freezers for the months ahead. It also rids farmland of pests. And these restrictions allow for it to happen safely and in a way that minimises the risk of losing the great progress that we've made, and also is in keeping with the principles that we've set out for Alert Level 3 around travel, around bubbles and around activity. We've also had discussions with Fish and Game about the duck hunting season. As many of you all know, the season is gazetted in advance and was due to begin on the 2nd of May. Cabinet was concerned that under the Level 3 guidelines for hunting, some people would be excluded from the season, perhaps in part because they lived at too great a distance to where they may need to be. There was also concern that if it started soon and people weren't able to take part, it would end up being a shorter season for some people. For that reason, the duck hunting season will go ahead in the second weekend after New Zealand moves to Alert Level 2. The season, once it gets underway, will be extended to make up for the delay. I know this will be disappointing for many, but we recognise that opening weekend is quite a social event for many people, and we still must reduce down contact at Level 3 as much as possible. This decision means all those who usually take part in duck hunting will be able to, just on a slightly different time frame than otherwise. I also want to be clear that hunting will be able to resume normally at Level 2. once we get there. Just today is not that day. On Saturday, Anzac Day, I will be one of many New Zealanders who will take part in an initiative called Stand at Dawn. The RSA has encouraged all of us to commemorate our service personnel by standing at the end of our driveways or near our letterboxes at 6 a.m. to stand at dawn. I know how hard it will be this year, our first Anzac Day in history where services have been cancelled due to COVID-19. But that doesn't mean we can't show our support as a collective. As dawn breaks, we can stand at the end of those driveways and together in silence and pay tribute to those we should never forget. We can still take time to pause, reflect and pay our respects to the people who have given so much to us. This year we are calling for all Kiwis worldwide to stand at their letterbox, their front door, their balcony or their essential place of work at 6 a.m. on April the 25th. The official dawn service broadcast will be on RNZ National Radio at 6 a.m. and will include an address by the Minister of Defence and Minister for Veterans, Ron Mark. If anyone wants to find out more details, I encourage you to visit standatdawn.com. And so in the spirit of recognising those who have been a part of our COVID-19 response, today I want to thank the New Zealand Defence Force, past, present and future, for all that you do to keep peace, to keep us safe, to help us recover from natural disasters, to help our Pacific neighbours, to reflect our strength of spirit across the world, and more recently, for your work on COVID-19. Some 60 expert planners and logistics personnel have helped with central government operations, such as health and police centres, as well as regional emergency operation centres. More than 600 have helped to manage isolation facilities and distribute care packages to those in need. This comes alongside usual work such as search and rescue and disaster relief. I'd like to make special mention of the crews from 5 Squadron and 40 Squadron of the Royal New Zealand Air Force, who have also been flying relief flights in support of our Pacific neighbours in Vanuatu, Fiji and Tonga, who have been hard hit by Tropical Cyclone Harold. We, as always, are grateful for your service. Thank you. I'm now happy to take your questions.
How many people have recovered?
The number of people who have recovered has increased by 29 and is now 1,065.
I've been in touch with that Dunedin, that family connected to the Dunedin fatality. They were on the radio this morning saying that they've been given false hope from these press conferences by saying that the person was stable.
Yes, so I haven't personally, but I know the medical officer of health has, and through our comms team cleared the statement I have made today with the family. So, yes, prior to yesterday, the information I had was that the person who has subsequently died was in critical condition, and yesterday it said stable, which reflected the fact there had been no change. But I am very sorry, because I think that from that story that did create some anxiety and concern for the family, so I'm sorry that happened, and I'm certainly happy to be in touch with them personally if they would like to.
We've also talked about in future maybe distinctions that talk about people being in ICU without necessarily the breakdown of their status within ICU, because in this case perhaps the health terminology will mean different things to different people, and no one wants to create any kind of extra additional distress for families, as obviously has been caused in this case.
Those verify the case-by-case basis on which family members will be able to visit their loved ones in hospital?
Sorry, do you mean under alert, undercurrent?
Under level 3.
Under level 3, yes, there is some new guidance going up on our website around this, and so that will be at the discretion of the senior clinician if a person does have COVID-19, and there will be provision for, if the clinician feels it's safe, there will be provision for a family member to visit, and PPE will be provided and its use will be instructed, so that will keep the family member safe.
No changes under level 4, is that right?
Sorry?
There are no changes in that
regard. No changes under level 4, that's an intention under level 3.
You were speaking before about under level 3 if someone's in palliative care or end of life care allowing visitors. The website says that visitors from the extended bubble with no suspicion of COVID-19 will be allowed one at a time, but that doesn't specify that it's just for palliative care.
That was an aged residential care facilities that I was talking about. The arrangement in aged residential care is still no visiting, except in the circumstances of whether it's a palliative situation, and then compassionate visiting will be organised through the facility manager.
In hospitals, people will be able to visit?
There will, the visiting policy is different in hospitals for people without COVID-19 anyway. There is an ability under Alert Level 3 for individual family members to visit.
On that Burwood group, are you able to give us an update of how many remain either confirmed or probable cases and what their conditions are?
I don't have that information, but I will seek out that information and we can make that available.
Certainly it is the case, isn't it, Dr. Bloomfield, that there are obviously a number around Rosewood who have been identified as having contracted COVID-19, and you know, devastatingly, of course, you're seeing then the impact of that on a vulnerable community. And so when we saw those initial deaths, it's obviously indicative of the fact that when it reaches those vulnerable communities, it is devastating. But there were a number who were positive.
Is that still the case, though, that I guess we spoke a couple of weeks back with you and you said it is possible that we'll see more deaths? This is still quite a... Or have we passed the worst of it with these group of people, or is it still a really big concern?
Well, if you think about the unit in which the infection happened and the people who were transferred to Burwood, these are people with quite advanced underlying conditions anyway. And so we have seen further deaths, as I alluded to, might happen, and there may well be others. As with the death today, even when there isn't a positive test, as there was in this case, we are being inclusive to make sure that we are capturing any death that could be COVID-19 related. But this is the group that is the most vulnerable and tends to have the worst outcomes from this infection.
How common is it that we get these negative tests? We haven't kind of heard about that too much before.
Oh, we talked a little bit in the beginning about it.
I think right from the start I've talked about the fact, and that's one of the reasons that we are thoughtful about when we're using testing, because a negative test, and for example, you know, sometimes we've seen cases that are still classified as probable, even they may have had repeated negative swabs, and that doesn't reflect a problem with the testing. And it I think, underscores our inclusive approach for making sure we are capturing and treating any probable cases as if they were a case and acting accordingly.
Prime Minister, you mentioned yesterday that provided that they collaborate with police and operate appropriately, that there's largely iwi-based checkpoints, that you're okay with them. When we move to level three, will you still be comfortable with these checkpoints operating?
Yeah, to the degree that they are working with civil defence and police, because keeping in mind it is only the police and civil defence who are lawfully able to stop people. And so I'm comfortable with the message I've received from the police that they're working well with communities on the ground where some of these checkpoints have existed to make sure that they are operating within the law and with the best interests of the community at heart.
To you, Dr. Bloomfield, people have approached us asking, people in the Māori community have approached us asking why there isn't data on ethnicity testing by region. Why is that?
We just haven't done the analysis, but we can provide that. We provided an updated analysis in the last few days by ethnicity and by region, and we can go further and do the breakdown by region, acknowledging that in some of the regions the numbers are relatively small, so the breakdowns may well, you know, there will be maybe small numbers in some of those groups. But yes, we're happy to do that.
So continuing on with that then, and publishing those and making those publicly available, that is in the works, and if so, when might that happen?
It can be done, because when we publish those laboratory data, we are linking them to the NHI number, and now we don't get 100% match, but we get a 96% match, and then the NHI carries information about age, ethnicity and so on, and the ethnicity is prioritised, so it has Māori prioritised. So we can do that. I'll talk to the team when I get back there today.
Should New Zealanders be able to get a refund from Air New Zealand rather than just credit for cancelled flights, particularly those who are now on hardship?
That's not something I've had raised with me, so a bit difficult for me to make a statement off the cuff. I'm sure Air New Zealand have been doing some work around, you know, what is fair under these current circumstances. If you wouldn't mind, I wouldn't mind taking a look at the issue before just giving you a response.
Do you think it would be fair for Air New Zealand to tell people they're not entitled to a refund or a credit because their flight is still departing?
Sorry, is it reasonable for them to say that they're... I mean, it's obvious to people that many of the flights in question are not still departing.
But they are still departing. Air New Zealand has in some cases said no refund, no credit, because yeah. they're still going.
Again, I would want to just go and look at some of the circumstances under which this is being applied. We are asking people, though, to be fair and reasonable under the circumstances. I know that there will be many people who will have trips booked that just aren't possible to undertake now. So if you wouldn't allow me just to go and have a look at some of the policies that are being released on that front.
Andrea. Elderly people who are spending unnecessarily long amounts of time in hospital because hospitals won't test for asymptomatic patients, but the rest homes won't allow them to return until they've had the test. So can you clear that up and give some clarity on what the situation is?
Yes, and I spoke to this at some length yesterday. So we've had and are having ongoing discussions with the Aged Care Association. What we agree on and what happens is any older person who's going into residential care or is returning because they've been in hospital, who is symptomatic and there's a low threshold for testing, is tested. And anyone who is positive does not go back until they have recovered and have clinically been determined to have recovered. But every resident going in or returning goes into 14 days of self-isolation and is tested if they develop symptoms. And the whole point of that 14-day period is that if they did have COVID-19 and had been exposed, I should say if there is any history of exposure, they are also tested, symptomatic or not. However, the advice of a range of professionals, including, you may have seen yesterday, the New Zealand Microbiology Network, is that routine testing is not helpful because it is a point in time in asymptomatic people. And this goes to the point I made earlier on, that actually even when we think someone is a probable case with a clear history of exposure, the test can still be negative. Mm-hmm. So we do not think routine testing is indicated.
Germany is making face masks compulsory in public, and Auckland Transport's asking passengers under level 3 to wear them on buses and trains. Where is the consideration at for whether New Zealand will see these sorts of measures under alert level 3 and 2?
So at this point, we're not recommending people use face masks routinely. We don't think it is an important part of our overall measures. The most important parts are the physical distancing and hygiene and other safety measures. And, of course, maintaining the bubbles. That's the really critical thing. Mm-hmm. This morning, actually, quite early, myself and colleagues were on a call with our British counterparts to share experiences, and this was one of the issues raised. Like us, they are carefully watching the evidence, and as their chief medical officer has said, you can find high-level specialists on both sides of the argument. So again, I think if people want to wear a mask, they should. They should know how to use it. But we don't think at this point there is any indication for routine use of masks in public.
What I do just want to urge is that it is no supplement, it is no substitute for social distancing. So if when it comes to public transport, we will still ask people to try and keep their distance, keep seats free, sit further back from other people if you're able. All of those basic measures we're asking people to maintain all the way through these alert levels.
Masks, isn't it wise that we err on the side of caution while evidence is still being evaluated?
At this point, we don't think that that's the important thing. The important thing is where we have emphasised our key messages, and those have served us well to date and will continue to. If people want to use a mask, they can, but they should know how to use it. Recalling again that there are disadvantages of using masks as well as possible advantages.
Dr. Bloomfield, would you mind expanding on the correct use and disadvantages of use as well?
Well, the correct use depends on the type of mask, but it is very important that you put it on and keep your hands away from your nose and mouth, and they usually hook behind the ears. The challenge then, and as we have all found, is we tend to unconsciously put our hands up to our face, and often if you're not used to wearing a mask, for example, you don't spend day after day in an operating theatre, the tendency is to then keep putting your hands to your face, and when the mask is wet, including, as we have seen recently down in Burwood, when the mask is wet, then it can transmit viruses, including COVID-19. So the key point here is meticulous hand hygiene And of course, most importantly, not going out if you're unwell.
Dr. Bloomfield, some private hospitals have raised concerns about not being reimbursed for staying open at full capacity during level 4 lockdown. They've cancelled electives, obviously, and lost a lot of income. Are steps being made? Is there progress being made to reimburse them for that, or will they be out of pocket?
Yes, there are. Prime Minister, did you want to talk to that? Because I know Cabinet has looked at... We certainly have been having active discussions with private hospitals because we...
So that's Director-General Ashley Bloomfield with Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. If you like to listen to those media conferences in full, you can do it on the website rnz.co.nz. There's another one coming up at 3pm today, as the Prime Minister mentioned, featuring statements from Civil Defence and the police.